Welcome back. We're going to start learning a little bit about the Ralbag today, for those who have not had the opportunity of learning about the Ralbag. Unfortunately, the Ralbag does not make it to the page of most of your classic Mikra'os Gedolos, which is why, unfortunately, educationally, he's been written out of the book, which is a tremendous disservice to the nation of Israel. There are versions. The very old ones have it, so the Ralbag does, but generally speaking, your average student of Chumash does not have access to the Ralbag, and it is a tremendous pity. So we're going to spend a little bit of time understanding that. But before we do that, today is a special day, and we thank three families for sponsoring today's shiur. First of all, for Rosemary, where Rosemary was just here a second ago. Yes. I'll wait a moment. We're going to thank the Berger family, because Moshe and Liora are sponsoring today's shiur as we commemorate the 30th Yahrzeit. It's a long time. For Moshe's father, Michael Berger, Zacharia ben Yosef Olav HaShalom. Michael was actually born in Munich, Germany. And he's lost his parents to the Nazis in the Second World War and was aboard the last Kindertransport to the UK. We remained 2 years until getting a visa to the United States. He lived in the Bronx with his wife and children, four children, and in 1971, when that neighborhood started to become dangerous, he, as sometimes we don't know the truth, but sometimes it takes the Holocaust survivor to understand that when things turn around, there's only one place for Jews, and that's Israel. And so he took his family and moved to Israel, was an ardent Zionist, a vocal supporter of Israel, and he lived there till 1994, till his patira, and brought up children who clearly have the right orientation when it comes to that as well. We should learn the lessons from him. Ezra Hashem, Nishmasai Eden. We also are going to be, we thank Rosemary Fish and welcome her back, who is sponsoring today's shiur in Hakaras HaTov and in honor of the birth of her second great-granddaughter. And welcome back, Rosemary, Ezra Hashem, many, many, many smachos to share as well. And we thank Barbara and Jack Siegel, who are sponsoring for the yard site of Jack's sister, which is on the 6th of Cheshvan, which will be in just 3 days, for Mrs. Sylvia Strick, Sima, Bas Alexander Zisha Halevi. What number of Yahrzeit is this, Jack?
2013.
Wow, so it's 11 years already now. The Shama should have an aliyah. Thank you for making this opportunity to learn. Let's jump straight into our learning. Folks, I don't know, just by a quick show of hands, how many people have ever studied the Ralbag? Just to study the Ralbag. Okay, good, I'm happy to hear this. There's a couple of people who did, but most people did not get there. The Ralbag is beyond the scope of appreciation. The Ralbag was fascinating, phenomenal. Let's start at the very beginning. So the Ralbag was known as, in academic literature, as Gersonides. It's one of the ways you'd call a person by the name of their father, like Maimonides was Rav Moshe ben Maimon. Rather, the Ramban was Nachmanides, Rav Moshe ben Nachman. So Rabbi Levi ben Gershon was known as Gersonides, at least academically speaking. But in our world, he is known as Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, the Ralbag, that is the acronym of his name. In Latin, because his writings were well known and well respected in academic circles as well, he was also known as Magister Lior Hebraeus. Hebraeus, of course, means Hebrew, Jew. Right, he was a very, very well-respected person, both in the realms of Torah and in the realms of academia. And academia spanned physics, astronomy, astrology, and philosophy. Very, very impressive person. Grew up in France, in Provence, and there was he had a time where it was a complicated time because we're now talking about post-Crusades. We're now in the 13th century leading to the 14th century, and we have this time where there's protected areas in France, but it wasn't easy. So he writes in his introductions that when he was trying to review one of the Pirushim he wrote on the Gemara, there weren't any Talmuds available in this particular area, because remember, this is after the burning of the Talmud in France, right? So France, which kicked out the Jews 6 times, multiple times for their money and their anti-Semitism at this point in time, you know, we're dealing with this that era. But nonetheless, even though there was a ban on Jews learning philosophy at this point in time, he somehow managed to learn philosophy and became a very big scholar of Aristotelian thought as well. He wrote many, many things. One of the most impressive things the Ralbag is known for is the creation of what's called of Jacob's staff. In fact, I put on the first page the stamp on the staff from the State of Israel which celebrates the achievements of great Jews. And in the picture on the first page is a picture of what's called Jacob's staff. Jacob's staff is an instrument which he used because he was a stargazer. And what he did was he was able to make an instrument in which he used the ratios between, it was a staff, just to describe it, it was a 4.5 foot or 1.4 meter long, which about 2.5 centimeters wide. And it had these perforated tablets which could slide along the staff. Because now what they would do is they would compare the distances between one of the upright rods and the other upright rod, which could slide and be measured. And then you would take the ratio of that to measure the distances you see in the celestial spheres, to therefore measure distance between stars, between interplanetary objects as well. And this was credited to him. This is a precursor to what became known later on as the sextant, which for measuring distance and as well. So this is a very impressive, we'll call a contribution to the world of astronomy. Indeed, in one of his works, he was the first person to prove mathematical induction. Right, so you know when you induce a formula, you induce a formula from a group of numbers, and he was able to prove mathematical induction works in one of his works as well. In fact, he was also one of the earliest people to notice that stellar distances are much larger than were known at the day. He was able to say based on his measurement of the skies that stars were not, as many had thought, actually part of a celestial sphere. Meaning, if you read the Rambam, which is not too much earlier than the Ralbag, based on the science of the time, the way they understood the stars worked were these rotating spheres around the Earth, which had different constellations of stars. And they all were in each of those, were called spheres that rotated around it. Right? The Rambam calls it the Galgal. The Rambam asks, who is moving the Galgal? Right? That's what the Rambam talks about in Hilchos Yosarei HaTorah. So the Ralbag says the stars are a lot further than we can imagine in the science of the day. And in fact, he was right. He said look at the number. 159651513380944 of Earth radii away. That's 100,000 light years. So he was on the right path before they had the instruments to know this as well. Also, at the time, they were still dealing with the Ptolemaic version of the world, in which it was seen as the Earth being the center of the rotation. And part of the problem with that was that when you looked at certain planets, they didn't operate in a way that it makes sense that the Earth is the center. So what do they create? They're called epicycles. This is the way that science tried to explain away the problems. So at the time, they called epicycles, which means that that each of the planets is doing its own little thing in circling the Earth to explain its movements, but it wasn't so simple. And he was the first person to have written and said, it doesn't fit, it's not working. And he questioned it, but he didn't have a solution, which obviously led later on to Galileo and Copernicus. But that was, the Gersonides, Ralbag was on the first people to question this. Unfortunately, because he wrote most of his writing in Hebrew, it's not unfortunate his writing is in Hebrew, but unfortunately because that not everything was known to the world. There were many of his works were translated by the church into Latin for the greater reading, but happens to be a forerunner in many realms as well. He is also like the Ibn Ezra has a crater on the moon named after him, as we discussed before. Again, folks, I don't know if you have anybody you know who's got a crater on the moon named after them. So this crater is called Rabbi Levi. That's the name of it, based on the Ralbag. It's the lunar. Its coordinates are 37.78 south and 23.46 east. So in case you're traveling past there, you will notice that that is where the Ralbag's crater is. And he wrote many writings. So he was a mathematician, and I was also a physician. That's how I forgot to mention as well. We talk about a maverick. We're talking about a person clearly not on the same level of intellect that your average person is. And he wrote a book on signs, accords, and arcs. He wrote a book on the harmony of numbers because he was requested by the bishop to write a book to prove the number of how many harmonic numbers there are, which means to say that they share the formula of 2n times 3n, and he proved that there are only four sets of harmonic numbers. That was a book that he wrote as well for the church. He wrote a book called Maaseh Choshev, dealing with arithmetic and operations, square roots, cube roots, and this is what he was writing as well. And then he also wrote many Svarim. As well, he wrote a book called Shari Tzedek about the 13 Midos that Rabbi Shmuel talks about in the morning that we learn about every day. He wrote a book called Mechokek Safun, which is about the Agada in the Gemara in Baba Basra. He wrote a number of responsa, not all of which we have extant today. He wrote the most famous book that he wrote is called Milchamos Hashem, the Wars of God, which is a philosophical work structured much like the Moreh Nevuchim, the Rambam, also dealing with Aristotelian philosophy and Jewish theology and trying to put the two together. Very complicated complicated work. We'll look at some of the ideas in just a moment. And he also wrote a commentary on the Torah and a commentary on Nach. So just remarkable. And it pays for us to have a little bit of humility when approaching him, because sometimes the first thing that people hear when they think about the Ralbag is questionable ideas. And one has to be very careful before to learn a little bit about the Ralbag before making any such statements. So let's jump straight in. The Ralbag was highly academically schooled, which means to say that even the form of his Pirush is very academically reflected. So as opposed to simply just a commentary on a pasuk, he has structure to the way his commentary operates. And the structure works as follows. At the beginning, he looks at the Torah not in chapters, but he looks at it in thematic, organized sections. So he will take a section and he'll say, this is the heading of the section. Then he'll say, I'm going to explain to you the words, which means say there's phrases, words which don't make sense. So the first section is, let's get the, we'll call the nuts and bolts. Clear. That's called Biur HaMilot, which he has the first thing. Then the next thing is Biur HaInyan. Once we've got past understanding the actual words and phrases, he goes and explains what's actually going on in the content over here. And the most famous and fascinating part of his Pirush is what he writes at the end, which is what he calls To'alot, which comes to the word To'elet. Today in Hebrew, To'elet means benefit, right? But it means the lessons. Ayin. To'elet. So he says, what is the lessons we can learn? He was very outcomes oriented. So he says, what are the lessons we can learn? He subdivides his lessons into three different types of lessons. He subdivides them into Deot, which he understands as theological, philosophical lessons to be learned. Midot, which are character or just practical matters to be learned from this section. And then Mitzvot or Azharot, which are commandments or prohibitions to be learned. That's the way he divides it. So again, we will have a heading. We have three sections, right? So explanation of the words, explanation of the idea, and lessons. The lessons then can go up to 20 lessons, right? You can have To'elet HaEchad, the first one, the second one, the third one, and each of them are subdivided into philosophical, practical character, and then also mitzvot and azarot. It is worthwhile noting the Ralbag is an expert in Talmud as well. So the Ralbag is not simply a philosopher. So he writes in the Gemara as well, and therefore a lot of his Pirush actually deals with halacha, right? So people think of the Ralbag as a philosopher. You should really read his Pirush, right? He was an expert on in the Gemara as well, and therefore a significant amount of his time in the Twilight are the Mitzvah and the Azarat. Let's take an example, and I apologize because those who don't have it, I did send out the link because of this, if anybody has it as well. But just an example is, let's say, the 12th chapter in Sefer Shmos. The reason I chose this is because there's a lot of mitzvahs over there. So his heading is Hachodesh Hazeh Lachem Al Kidur Ad Kadesh Likol Bechor. So it tells you where he's reading from and to, which is chapter 12 and 13 of Shmos. So it tells you the framework of which this section is. The first thing he does is the Biur HaMilot. Sometimes today you'll see the Biur HaMilot as a separate sefer or separate section, right? But nonetheless, it was really the first part of his explanation. And so he goes through the Pesukim, and as an example, he says, El Moshe Vel Aaron. Rotzeh Lama, this means to say, Shekfar Amar Hashem Yisalel Moshe, Shomar Zeh LaAaron, Ki Aaron Hoyolo Lopeh. What does it mean that Aaron is being addressed? Aaron is not a prophet, generally speaking. Yes, says the Ralbag, Aaron was not talked to in this section. Aaron was, in fact, the recipient of Moshe's explanation to Aaron. So he's just making a clarification, which you might misunderstand. You might think Hashem is speaking to Moshe and Aaron. No, Hashem was speaking to Moshe to speak to Aaron, as was indicated before. And more Aaron, you and Yeviecha, Aaron will be your mouthpiece. Okay, it's just, and he goes through tens and tens of psukim. I just gave one example over here. It happens to be in the Biur HaInyan, or the Biur Divrei HaParsha, which is explaining it, he spends a lot more time when it comes to, let's say, Sefer Bereishis, where there's a lot more to deal with. In this section, he says, it's mostly understood by itself, so you don't need me to explain it to you. If you go back to Bereshit, there are much more extensive essays in this middle section here. I want to give an example of just of lessons, right? So it's just fascinating. This is really, really fascinating. You can learn so much from this. As an example, HaTo'eles HaRishon, the first lesson, he says, in the section of, remember, the nation of Israel leaving Egypt, bringing the Korban Pesach, and all the halachas, chametz, matzah, that business, that's all in Perek Yud Beis and Perek Yud Gimel. He says, first lesson is, Hashem wants us to set the calendar. How does he want us to set the calendar? Months and years. That's what he wants us to do. And then he does a unique thing. Whenever he deals with the mitzvah, he subdivides it into what he calls shorashim. Shorashim are literally roots. Again, you can just see the academic, you can sort of see the bullet points here, right? Right, and the indents, right? This is how he thinks, right? So the shorashim are the specifics of the mitzvah. So he explains that the Chodesh was declared based on the sighting of the moon. That's point number one. And the Beis Din needed to be able to receive this and declare. So these are the first two of the Shorashim, of nine Shorashim on this particular point. I'm just giving an example of this. So he's now explaining it. Then you think, okay, so this is a halachic section. But then if you flip the page, HaTo'eles HaSheni, the second lesson is, B'dayos, this is an ethical lesson to be learned, he says now. V'uloidia. It's good for people to live in neighborhoods with good neighbors. How does he know this? Because when it talks about the fact that the Korban Pesach was eaten to the Minyuyav, to those who are around, that means to say, to the Bnei Chabura, that means to say that, let's say you didn't have enough people in your unit of your family to be able to eat an entire Korban, you would go to your neighbors. Or if there's a person living alone, they would join, right? So he says it's important to have good neighbors, right? So you see, by the way, we just switched lanes there, right? right? We're dealing with the myths of Kiddush HaChodesh, and now we're dealing with where to buy a house, okay? And then he goes on in the next lesson. It was not the next. It's the HaTo'eles HaShmini. This is now the eighth lesson in this particular section. Who be midos? Okay, so this is character and practical aspects of life. V'usha'en ro'i l'holchei drachim shi'archu b'su'udav yis'yashev bo. When you're traveling, don't settle down for your lunch too long, he says, right? Meaning to say, well, how do we know this? Because the way they ate the Korban Pesach is mosnechem chagurim. He says, when you're traveling, when there's a need to go, he says, your loins girded. Means to say, is when you're traveling, you got somewhere to go, you're somewhere leaving somewhere perhaps, then it's important not to take too many breaks. That's a practical act. Do you see what he's doing here? He's sort of distilling all the ideas over here into halachic, ethical, and practical outcomes. That's remarkable. That's remarkable. And then he goes on, just as an example, the 20th lesson, this particular one, because this is a long section, he says, is the lesson of what he calls an azhara. The azhara is the flip side of a mitzvah. The mitzvah is what to do. The azhara is what not to do. In this particular case, he says, "Ulizkor shuzarnu shaloi noitzi min abayis mi basar ha-pesach." We can't take the Pesach outside of the house. And then he explains that the Shoresh HaRishon, again, because it's a mitzvah, he explains the roots. He says, that means to say that when you eat, you need to be eating within a framed area. You need to have walls around you for it to be such. Okay, so you see, this is the flip side of that as well. The logic is very clear. The structure is the way it works the entire Torah through. And this is how it works. If you want to say to yourself, what lessons can I learn from the Torah? Go to the Ralbag at the end. And he'll go through the toilet one after the next, and he'll tell you what kind of toilet it is. He'll tell you, is this lesson ethical, practical, a mitzvah? Phenomenal. It's really, really remarkable. So now, a few things just to be aware of in methodology, which are really, really interesting. Number one is how does he deal with the words of Chazal? Okay, so we've seen this before, and this is one of the biggest struggles of the Mefarshei HaPshat. How do you deal with a divergence between what you understand the text is trying to tell you on a simple level and what Chazal interpreted in this as well? So again, like many of those who came before him, if there's something like that is in the realm of Agada in philosophical works, the Ralbag will disagree many times with the way of understanding. We'll see a few examples in just a moment. But when it comes to Halacha, it's fascinating. He has a completely unique way of looking at things. This is so fascinating. You see, you remember this is the biggest struggle, is the Rashbam and the Ibn Ezra, right? The Ibn Ezra, you sacrosanct is halacha, you can't disagree with it. The Rashbam is willing to have multiple levels of interpretation which are not contradicting with each other. How do you deal with this? The Ralbag has a unique way of dealing with halacha. Because remember, he is a halachist himself. If you read his pirush, I would say a majority of the Ta'alot are are mitzvahs, right? Because that's what the significant amount of the Torah is. How does he deal with it? So he says in his introduction the following. This is a remarkable argument. I put it down over here in source two. However, I'll read the first two words and the first two lines, and then just to discuss outside. He says, "Vinei, b'bira mitzvahs ha'asharashim." And understanding the mitzvahs and their roots, that's what we just looked at. Asher mem yetsu kol dineihem. From them, all the laws will extrapolate. Asher yisba'aru b'chochmas ha-talmudiyim, which are explained through the Talmudic wisdom. Lo yiyeh b'min ha-geinu, b'chol ha-mekomois lismoich osom ha-shorashim el ha-mekomois asher somchu osom chachmei ha-talmud ba'achas mi-yud gimel miros lifnei mi-nagam. I'm not going to rely on the way that Chazal derived the laws as they derived them through the 13 hermeneutical principles of Rabbi Yishmael. What does that mean? He has his observation, such a profound observation. He believes that when the Torah was given, there was a Torah Shebichsav and a Torah Shebalpeh. It was the written law and there was the oral law. When it came to the oral law was given at Sinai with everything incorporated into it as well. So therefore, when the Torah tells us about the Esrog and the Pri Etz Hadar, Moses was told, Moshe Rabbeinu was told, that refers to the citron, that's the Esrog, right? No questions asked. Then Chazal have a number of drashas to arrive at that. So if you look at the Gemara in Sukkah says, what does the Pri'etz Hadar mean? Ah, so it's Hadar, it comes back from year to year, or it's beautiful, right? There's a few explanations given. Says the Ralbag, all of those are all asmachtot. What does that mean? They are all ways of trying to link the din, the law, to the text itself. He says, but that's not an absolute scale, which means to say, that wasn't a derivation, it was a connection.
Working backwards.
Which, by the way, just to be fair, many of the Mefarshim understand that there are drashos and asmachtos. So the Malbim spends a lot of his time on this particular topic. What is a drasha? What is an asmachta? When did you look at the pasuk? When did Chazal look at the pasuk and expound it outwards? Or when did Chazal know the truth and then append it to a hint in the pasuk? The Ralbag says everything is appended, which means, therefore, he points out, you could now look at a drasha Chazal and say, hey, this doesn't make so much sense, and arrive at the wrong conclusion if all you had was the drasha as well. He says, I'm going to give what I feel are tighter connections between the din and the pasuk, which I believe will in fact be more compelling than what Chazal was saying, which means, is the Ralbag disagreeing with the din? Absolutely not. God forfend. But what he's doing is he's saying the way to link it to the pasuk, I'm going to suggest other methodologies. As an example, here's just an example. So this is a few simple examples. When it comes to tefillin, the Torah says, So how many are there? So the Gemara goes to extreme lengths to explain. Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Akiva, Totafos is it says it three times, two in the singular, one in the plural. So that's one, one, and two, right? Singular, singular. Just and then plural minimum two is four. So there's four sections. There's four sections of the head, and then it goes. And it says the oisal yodecha is as it's one sign on the outside, it's one sign on the inside, which is why there's one parchment. That's what the Gemara learns based on two brises. The Ralbag just says totafois is plural, and ois is singular, right? Meaning you say just the language, right? Totafois is plural, and by the way, it's very helpful because his observation, which he makes, as you could end at the wrong conclusion, is correct in this case. Which is, it's the drasha of Chazal, at least Rabbi Shmuel's words, are based on the fact that the three times the word Totafos appears in the Torah is one singular, and one plural. Meaning that Totafos is chaser, chaser, male, which means it's missing a vav, which looks like it's singular two times, and one time it's male. That's not the way our Torah is written it. Meaning our way of having the male and chaser is different, which means you'd come to a different conclusion if you were to go follow that. The Ralbag therefore sidesteps that. Right, another example. We say that it's between your eyes, right? So the Tzedek and the Sadducees would say that tefillin is worn in the, between the eyes. So we know that that's not the case. And Alpi Chazal, it refers to actually it indicates in the middle of the head, right? So the Ralbag, it can't be in between the eyes because how could you see if you had a tefillin in between your eyes? Meaning, the Ralbag is so simple. He says, how do you know it's on your left hand, as an example? So the Torah says, because Yadcha, the one time the word Yadcha, referring to your hand, is with a hey at the end. Yadcha as opposed to a chaf safis. So this is Yad Keha, your weaker hand. So for most men, that is your left hand. for a significant number of the population, it's the right hand. Right? But, says the Ralbag, no. He says, because it's actually meant to be the predominant, the dominant hand is supposed to be the right hand, so that's the one that should be doing the wrapping. Right? As opposed to which hand it's on. Meaning, the point isn't whether which hand it's on, but which hand is actually doing the action of putting it on. Again, so these are, the Ralbag does this numerous times, where he says, I know what the outcome is, and Chazal knew what the outcome is, and I'm going to show you how to get there in a much more logical fashion in many times, which is fascinating as well. Do you see how this is different to the Ibn Ezra? Different to the Rashbam? Very unique approach, and he does it across the Torah as well, in such a way. So one has to be careful when saying how the Ralbag deals with Chazal. He deals with Chazal with great deference. What he's trying to do is fortify the conclusions they have from the Torah Shebaal Peh, from the oral Torah and the transmission and the tradition as well. We'll look at a few themes of the Ralbag, which are very, very famous themes, and perhaps a little surprising to those who have not yet been schooled in this philosophy. The general rule is the Ralbag is a rationalist. Okay, so the Ralbag works within the realm of rational, within the realm of rules. He is not a Kabbalist. He's not coming from that realm, although he does touch on astrology from a perspective of physics. Okay, so without going into further depth, he tries to explain how astrology, right, and how stargazers can understand from a perspective of physics what's about to happen. So he tries to merge the two. That's really unusual. But nonetheless, so miracles is one of the big topics the Ralbag talks about. And the Ralbag actually has a number of rules as to how miracles can and cannot work as well. For this, we're going to actually turn to the works of the Ralbag in the Milchamas Hashem, again the wars of God. In this, he makes an observation about three important rules about miracles. Rule number one about miracles, he says, meaning this is the rules that Hashem chose to work in this universe. It's not that God is limited by these rules; it's the rules that Hashem chose to use to operate within this world. This is on top of page 7 for those who have it in front of you. He says the following: Nire v'nomat tchila. This is again, if you want to know, this is in Book 6, Section 2. Chapter 12. Okay, I just want to make clear that everything is very clear here. This is not a run on words. This is the run on sentence. It's everything is subdivided very clearly with headings. So in this section where he deals with miracles, he says, I want to tell you first. Shekfar yireh. It seems she'iyav shar she'is chadesh davar ma'mi anifloes imoshech mitziosu mitzios matzmid. Hashem will not create a miracle which is a continual miracle. Hashem will not subvert natural physics in a way that will be continuous. It'll always be temporary and then reverting. Similar to the sea, Vayosha v'mayim le'ei sanoi, that the water returned to its original being or state of being, and Chazal interpreted le tana'oi, to its condition. Meaning to say, physics will always return to its moment. There's no such thing as an everlasting miracle.
Okay? Huh.
No, not according to the Ralbag, no. We'll see in a second how he views that, which leads to the second one, which is number two is he says, principle number two is of Namar Od, and again, this is I'm taking the first part of the paragraph of an extensive essay. Hashem will never create a miracle which is internally contradictory. Okay, an internally contradictory miracle. What does that mean? He does this all the time. It's amazing. This appears in his Pirush on the Torah Nach all the time. He says, "Ki'ilu tamar shiashuv shachor lavan." To say, let's say that black will become white, vu shachor, but really it's black. Bederach shiiskabtsu amakbilim yachad benosei echad mitzad echad. Ki tekef shenaniach davar nimtza boze hatoar hinei tiyeh zoyes hanacha soiseres nafsho. You cannot have something which, by definition, is one way, which is now going to be another way at the same time. So he says, "Zeh ki mashu lavan eninu shachor." Right, meaning the reason why something is like a different color is because it absorbs or reflects light. It cannot do both at the same time, right? It cannot be that a God is doing the same, allowing that to happen the same. It cannot exist. You cannot have a triangle, right, which doesn't have three corners and 180 degrees with all the angles added up. It doesn't work. I mean, Hashem will not create a triangle which doesn't work. Hashem will not create a round square. So, meaning to say, there are rules within which miracles need to behave, and they can only be within the constraints of those of that physics as well. So, fascinatingly enough, across all of the Torah and across Tanakh, the Ralbag will deal with this. So, for instance, when he talks about Kriyas Yamsuf, when he talks about the Yarden stopping, right? Remember, the Jordan River did not split. Rivers don't split, they stop. Seas split, right? Just everybody, everybody talks about this all the time. Rivers don't need to split, right? They're flowing, right? So, as you know, we say it in Hallel all the time, but most people don't realize. So when it comes to these kind of miracles, the Ralbag will talk about certain pressures, certain winds, certain mists, atmospheric pressure, which will allow this to happen. And by the way, it happens. It does happen. There are times where bodies of water will split, will recede, will stop. In fact, I believe the last time that the Jordan River actually had this was up, but somewhere in 1927. It's documented, Nancy.
It's all about the timing.
Exactly. So the Ralbag's observation is timing. He says, so what's miraculous about this if it can happen? The answer is God said it's about to happen when you put your feet in the Jordan. And it happened then. And it stopped when they took their feet out. That's the miracle. Meaning the mechanism is a natural mechanism which is replicatable. You can see it happen. It's been documented, right? But that's all random. When God says this is going to happen now when you do this, the sea is going to split when you go in, that's the miracle. The miracle is not the way it happened, but the timing within which it happened is the way the Ralbag understands it. So the miracle, so to speak, within the framework of the laws of physics, but it's about when Hashem says it will happen, it's about to end happening, and that's how it goes. Fascinating, right? Completely different way of looking at miracles. By the way, you should know that people like the Malbim are not so excited about this, right? So people like the Malbim at the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua, dealing with the Jordan River stopping, describes that he brings the Ralbag in, and he says, listen, God made the system. God can just stop the system, right? So meaning to say, God is not limited by the rules. The Malbim is very happy to say that God can make water just pile up however way he wants to, and he can stop water flowing. It's totally fine. And by the way, we should look inside of ourselves as to where we sort of our natural, we'll call comfort of how we understand this. And it depends on how rationalistically we're brought up or Kabbalistically we're brought up. Depends on this particular debate as well. Liara, yeah.
What about the
Snan? Oh, the Snan and Nicole. So he has a question about burning fires which don't burn people. Like, for instance, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, right, as another example. I don't fully understand his words there because he says you can't create a cold fire, right? I think what he says is that's an example of a self-contradictory miracle, right? But what it sounds to me is that he gives the wherewithal of the entity in it not to be burnt. He protects that entity from being burnt. I don't understand fully what that means. Another thing he says, again, because you have very interesting miracles, he says, as an example, let's say when Moshe's staff turns into a snake, right? He points out that HaKadosh Baruch Hu could only, turn it into something which is an existent as well. So how that actual miracle worked, you know, but the point is that it couldn't turn into a dragon, right? It had to turn into something which is already within the well, called the table of contents as well. Rosemary, yeah.
What about the hail with the fire inside?
Yeah, well, that's not as clear from the Pesukim. It's not so clear from the Pesukim that what exactly is going on over there. We should look at the Ralbag there. I haven't had a chance. I would love to go through every miracle, but I want to actually get the rules. So we should go to all they are all fascinating cases. And I don't want to represent the Ralbag because I didn't do every single Ralbag. That's Ari. But hang on. So I want to do one last rule of the Ralbag, which is really important. And that is also an idea where the Ralbag says Hashem does not change celestial realities. So he says in the third principle, God does not change the celestial spheres. Now the Ralbag can say this with definity because the Ralbag is gazing at them. Meaning to say, it's not simple just to say that things stop. Right? Because there's a lot out there. There's a lot out there that doesn't just stop. Right? Meaning, say, if you understood the weight of the earth, the speed that it is orbiting, and the speed of the moon, you can't just freeze things. Right? It doesn't work like that. Right? So Hashem, therefore, will operate within the framework. So you say, but wait a second. We have an explicit example of where the Torah, or actually the Nach, tells us that it does. And that is in Perek Yud in Sefer Yehoshua, Shemesh Begivon Dom, where Yehoshua says he is chasing the enemies as a coalition of five Canaanite kings who are fighting against Israel. The tide turns, Israel's now chasing them. And Yehoshua turns out and he says, let the sun stay still in the Emek Ayalon. And they chase the enemies, they capture them in that time. And so it sounds like, you know, the freeze button works, right? So, and that happened. So how did that work exactly? The Ralbag says, You misunderstood this. From the human perspective, what was happening was, is they had the capacity to chase the enemies at an incredible speed, and they were able to do it within the span of one day what regularly in a battle would never happen. Which means from the human perspective, it seemed like time was standing still because of their increased ability to be able to do that. Which means, well, it wasn't about the sky stopping, but it was about humanity being having an expedient experience as well. That you understand what he's doing? He says, because Hashem would not change things.
That's self-contradictory, because to speed human beings up also changes physics. You can't make an
muscle
work faster. You're just changing one thing. He's fixing astronomy and going.
No. So just to clarify this. So I'm sure we've all had times where we had impossible tasks in a day, and somehow we met everything came together in the right way, and that's what he's saying. I mean, he's saying there was an astounding amount of everything lining up, that everything worked out. They were able to capture the enemies. Because remember, you can't fight at night in those days. There's no flares, right? So they were able to do everything they could within the time. I don't think he was saying that they got superhuman strength. He was just saying everything worked out. That's the way it is. You can understand why people will criticize this as well. In the more well-called conventional way of looking at it, that was the other half of the day that came from the time of Avram at the middle of the night, right? So there's and time. The Ralbag is pointing out is that there's a system over here. You can't just stop one part of that system, right? So now the answer to that would be, for the more classical understanding, is God created the system. Of course he can stop the system, right? So that's another element of this. Let's just look at one or two other aspects of the Ralbag, because it really is fascinating. Is the Ralbag places a great emphasis on human initiative. Okay, so the Ralbag describes a multiple times about human initiative. Here, one example where he disagrees with Chazal, and this is just like is something which is, you know, which we are accustomed to learning, and the Ralbag says completely different. Yosef is in prison. Yosef interprets the dreams of the butler and the baker, and then he tips off the butler as well. Says the Ralbag in source 10, he says, "Toiles hashvi'i ubimidos." He says, "I've got a practical lesson for you in Midos in source 10." Who shiroi lo adam shlishtadel b'chol oiz dinatzel me'ara asher hu boy. A person should take advantage of any opportunity they have to escape their circumstances which are negative. B'chol asibos asher efshar loy shi'azor bohem, v'lo yismoch al hanes. Don't rely on miracles. God sent the helicopter, take it. Which means to say that Chazal would say he was punished for doing the shtar, which is a very hard Chazal to understand in general. It's very hard to understand that Chazal. And on Rosh Hashanah, we spend a little time looking at the Arachaim over here and his interpretation of that Chazal. But the Ralbag says no. That was the correct thing to do. He was supposed to speak to the butler. That was his only recourse. Right? So I mean to say, and the Ralbag throughout course will talk about human initiative. As another example, when it talks about understanding the Migdal Bavel, right? So we just learned about that yesterday. Most people spend a lot of time thinking about the flood. They don't talk about the next development of humanity, urbanization. Right? So the Psukim in Perek Yud Aleph in Bereishis describe how they start making this big Migdal in Shinar, and they start, everybody comes together, and Hashem is not so excited about this and splits up the languages and throws everybody around, and like everybody goes away and builds their own places. So what was the concern at this time? And there's a vast array of options and opinions. So, you know, you can look at Rashi at Avodah Zarah. You know, we talk about ziggurats and the idea of, you know, the towers of the pyramids of Ur, and understanding they were shrines to the realm of light and dark. If you go back archaeologically, that's what Rashi was referring to. Very clear that that's what was going on over here. There's a, you know, you go to other explanations which are understood. The Arba Barnel, the Rabbag says very simply, is that making a city in a certain sense is a safe mechanism. What happens is that we all stay together, and now we're all protected because we don't have to risk going out to settle. Settle comes with a lot of risks and difficulties, because now we have to drain the swamps, we have to protect ourselves against the elements, we have to till the new land. But the risk is worth it, because God wanted us to cultivate the earth around us as well, with obviously the necessary checks and balances. So this safety was not God's intention for humanity. He wanted humanity to go out as well. In a certain sense, if you think about it, it's like Japan, right? What do you do when you can't build outwards? You build up and down, right? Manhattan, Japan, like, you know, Tokyo, right? There's no space. But that wasn't what God wanted from humanity. God wanted humanity to move outwards, not upwards and downwards. And that's what urbanization, Amygdala is sort of taking more space and using the confines of safety together. Ibn Ezra, the Baal Ralbag says, go outwards. And that's why, what did Hashem do? Hashem simply allowed them to miscommunicate, which doesn't take too much for human beings. I mean, it's like, yeah. And all that took is, and then everybody goes out and they do what they're supposed to be. But the mandate of humanity is to expand, to take risks, to cultivate, to be out there. There's a great emphasis on human initiative. At the same time, the Ralbag always talks about Hashkacha. The Ralbag has an incredible amount of discussion about the divine providence. The Ralbag is a believer that there's Hashkacha Klalis, which means to say general providence over all things. But there's also Hashkacha Pratis, but not for everybody. But by the way, this is not new. The Ramban talks about this too. The Ramban is very much a proponent of this idea, that divine providence on the individual is not for every individual. It depends if you opt in, right? So, or you sometimes you can opt out. You can want to just be part of the Hashkacha Klalis, and good luck, try that out. But the point is that the Ralbag over here is of a similar nature, and he talks about this all the time. He talks about it in the flood, the Mabul. He talks about the Hashkacha Klalis of humanity not making it, Hashem needing to restart humanity. But the Hashkacha Pratis on Noach as being the person who behaved in a way of, in a fashion that warranted being on that Teva as well. He talked about, like, as an example, let's look at when Avraham Avinu has Yitzchak. Look at source 13, a shorter one. Hatoyles Reviu B'Deos. There's a philosophical, a theological lesson here. V'ul Yashev B'Libeinu Emunas Hashkacha Asher Tiyeh B'Shem Yisaleh B'Tovim Ad Shiyaseh Hashem Yisporach Mehaplaim Mitzad Hashkacha Yecheseh Avraham L'Mishpat L'Davar Ra'uy. So he says that when Avraham Avinu is a child, we should see Hashem cares about people who do good things. Hashem will answer in situations. Sometimes people paint the Ralbag as a person who's sort of like, you know, detached or one step removed, academic. You've got to be very careful before, like, you know, as making accusations about a sefer you haven't read. You know, the Ralbag is deeply, deeply religious, and talks about Hashem's relationship in our lives multiple times. Hashkacha is one of the words he talks about almost all the time. Another example is even let's say you are not within Hashkacha Pratis, if you're associated with people who are warranted, you are luckier. You are going to be extended as into that as well. So for instance, when it comes to Yishmael is saved when he's about to die of thirst, that Hashem allows Hagar to realize there's a well right over there. Right? Why was he saved? So says the Ralbag, not by Sherusham because of the future. And the Ralbag says because he was the family of Avram. Avram was receiving Hashkacha Pratis, and therefore those associated with Avram Avinu warranted as well, which means our association is very important as well when it comes to our Hashkacha. These are some of the rules. Just to add to this, and I didn't have a chance to put this into this over here as well, is that the Ralbag has a unique view of omniscience. Omniscience is how Hashem views the world. Everybody struggles with this. The Rambam, the Ravid, the Ramban, all the medieval, all the commentators, all the Rishonim deal with this particular topic. The Gemara does too, but it doesn't express it as a question, just deals with it. But the Rishonim all ask it as a question. How is it that HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows everything, yet at the same time gives us the warrant, the license to do things, to have free will? This is a question everybody asks as well, and everybody tries to put the pin in the spectrum in a different place to try to understand it as well. How then can Hashem punish us for doing things which He prophesies will happen if ultimately we were choosing to do it, but Hashem knew it was going to happen? These are very complex questions around. Deals with the Nichos Tshuva, the fifth perek. The Ravid disagrees in two ways. The Ramban disagrees with that. There's a lot of really fascinating discussion on this topic. The Ralbag actually has a very fascinating, we'll call, model, where he limits again the way that Hashem operates. Hashem chose to limit the way that He operates, just to understand those rules, based on the rules of free will, which means, which do you give more predominance to? Do you say Hashem knows more, and therefore there's a limitation as to how much we can do? So as an example, that model is more like, does a human being have the ability to walk around on a boat? Like, does a person have free will to walk on a boat? The answer is, yeah, mostly, you know, if you're third class or you're steerage, a little less, right? But let's say you're on a boat and you have the ability to walk around. But how much do you have to walk around is just the footprint of the boat. You can't walk outside of it, the boat's moving, right? So that's one model that people talk about in terms of how much control Hashem has and how much control we have to make decisions within that framework, right? So we're walking on the boat, but the boat is still going south, right? So, like, meaning to say, that's one view. But that view, and that's that example, is giving more predominance to God, right? Meaning to say, the boat's still... The Ralbag is different. The Ralbag actually says that Hashem, in a certain sense, gave us the capacity to make choices, and therefore there are millions of outcomes which are non-deterministic, And others, Hashem may not even know which one is going to be the future because we make the decision to do that. That's a limitation in omniscience. That's a very significant limitation, which is, by the way, very helpful in certain ways, just to understand this. Somebody asked me this question last time. Comes the end of Parshas Bereishis, and Hashem says, humanity? Vayinochem Hashem ki asisim. Look what they did. Bestiality, anarchy, relationships without accountability. So Hashem didn't know that. The Ralbag will say, no. Hashem gave humanity the license of free will. Hashem said, I'm taking a step backwards. I want to see what you do. And we really messed it up. We really messed it up, right? Then Hashem came back and says, okay, this wasn't good. We're going to have to restart now. Noach, we're going to figure this. You're going to be the new starter. But the point is that how could it be there's regret if there wasn't the chance for the Hashem to reflect upon the outcomes of what was going to happen, which is now limiting the we'll call the omniscience, which is some people say, oh my goodness. And that's why you'll have people who are critical of the Ralbag. You'll look at the Rivash in his Tshuvas, who says, not so sure, the Arbabinel. The Malbim will criticize the Ralbag, and some people even would say that's why he's removed from the page, is because some of these ideas move too much in the direction of, we'll call rationalism, and well, the human responsibility of action, if that makes sense. I want to just close this, I'm sorry. And so just to put that in perspective, I think that everybody struggles with the same thing, and I'll use, I apologize, a mundane example, Lahavdil. And that is that for anybody who ever reads science fiction or fantasy, one of the most frustrating things when reading fantasy and science fiction is that it's not consistent, right? Is that are there rules in the newly created universe, world, parallel, whatever it is? And a lot of times they aren't consistent. And you'll learn things later on, which can now be questioned, is why didn't that happen? Why wasn't that ability, that new thing, used earlier on? And there's nothing more frustrating than inconsistency in realms of thought as well, right? And we're frustrated by that as well. Lahavdil elef alfei avdalos. But what the Ralbag is introducing over here is he's saying Hashem chose to operate within a world. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave rules to this world. And it can't just be that those rules just get waived every 2 seconds. There's rules Hashem chose to operate. The way that Foreman made the observation, and it's sometimes very profound, is imagine that you are playing Monopoly with Parker Brother, right? He's the guy who invented the game, right? And you get like the blue street, the dark blue property, and you put a hotel and he lands. Park Place, it depends on every country, by the way. Every country's got a different name because depending on their country, right? And then you can get the Star Wars one and you forget about it. But like, you're right, so, but let's get to you. The dark blue, the biggest property, you put the hotel there and Mr. Parker lands on your hotel. And he says, listen, he says, I invented the game. Give me a bit of a reprieve. So he says, you may have invented the game, but you chose to play with me. Meaning to say, that means to say that Hashem, Lahavdil, right? Hashem created the framework. Hashem chose to operate within the framework. Right? That's what Ralbag is saying. That's not a limitation, Hashem. Hashem can choose to evaporate the framework at any moment. Right? He chooses not to. Right? But Hashem has chosen to operate within certain rules. What the Ralbag is trying to understand is, what are the rules? What is the framework of the rules? And what the Ralbag is knowing, now looking out of the world, understanding mathematical induction, understanding astronomy and astrology, understanding physics, and it being a front runner in his generation academically and scientifically, he's saying this is a complex system that Hashem chose to create. I need to understand how the system works with the way that Hashem chose to work, because that system he created and decided to abide by. That's what the Ralbag is saying over here. And to many, that's more disturbing, right? To many of the more conventional thinkers, that's something which is more difficult to absorb. First of all, because they weren't exposed to the complexities of that system in the same way, which was what creates the difficulty as well. But also because the understanding is Hashem has the license to create, stop, and continue at any point that system as well. Well, the Ralbag says it's so profound, it needs to be within the confines of the system as well. Really, really, really fascinating individual, really fascinating ideas. And I would say that's something I think which most people don't get a chance to have the opportunity of learning, of appreciating, and understanding in a more sophisticated way. I advise everybody, if you want to, take a moment and find the Ralbag. Thank you, Dr. Jaeger, for the Moser HaKoach. I was looking for this, I couldn't find it. Take the Ralbag. There's many versions around. And look at the lessons at the end. It's available on Svaria, the Ralbag is available on Svaria. Take a look at it. Look at the lessons. And there's so much to be learned, Be'ezrat Hashem. I appreciate everybody taking the time. I'm going to take questions afterwards as well now. Thank you so much, everybody, for...